Ah, yes, let the healing of the earth begin. This is Michael Stone. You're listening to Conversations. I'm here with my very special friend and broadcaster, Jody Saleen. And she's going to tell you what we're listening to, aren't you?
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me join you in the station. Well, we're about to embark on a discussion about green building with some very special guests.
Yes, we are. But before we do that, we want to say that this is KVMR 89.5 FM in Nevada City. We're just going to learn how to dance here, Jody and I. So just stay with us. And I just got into Copenhagen just a few hours ago. So we're going to read you the community calendar and start out with hip-hop bands Wink from Brazil, Augustus Telefant, Mr. Rogers, and Graham perform Tuesday night at the Crazy Horse downtown Nevada City.
And here's a great holiday gift tip. This season, give the gift of John McCutcheon. Just think how happy you'll make either new or returning fans as we all celebrate John's 20th anniversary KVMR concert, Saturday, January 23rd at the Grass Valley Veterans Hall. Give this great gift of live performance, not more stuff, online at kvmr.org. Charge by phone during KVMR business hours at 530-265-9073 or head to the ticket outlets, KVMR's office in Nevada City, The Bookseller and Briar Patch in Grass Valley, and Cherry Records in Auburn, and the Sacramento Natural Foods Co-op. For more information, go online, kvmr.org or 265-9073.
And we've got Troubadour Trouble in Nevada City. Troubadour Trouble will perform at the Old 5 Mile House on Route 20 in Nevada City, Tuesday, 6:30 to 9:30. For more information, call 273-5489. So thank you all for listening and supporting Conversations and KVMR. It's great to be back with you. I know you think I was here, but those were recorded shows that we played. I hope you enjoyed Joanna Macy and Richard Miller. So also want to thank Sierra Solar Systems, serving the foothills and the environment for 29 years, offering PG&E and remote system design and installation. Their solar-powered showroom and warehouse is at the Alternative Building Center, 563 Idaho Maryland Road, Grass Valley, 530-273-6754. So most of you know Jody Saleen as a great broadcaster on the Women's Show and many other shows. But she has another life, believe it or not. She was the owner and founder of Organic Tours. She's been renovating houses for years in Nevada County and now in the San Francisco Bay Area. I talked her into coming back, just in case I couldn't stand up after an all-night, all-day flight. And she is also a LEED certified sustainability specialist. Her motto is One Planet, Many Solutions. And one of the reasons I invited her, because we're going to talk about green building today. And I want to start out by introducing our guests, Lynn and Jason. Let's make sure you're on the line. Are you both on the line?
Good afternoon.
Ah, Jason, you still there?
I'm still there.
All right.
Okay.
So go ahead, Jody.
So we just briefly heard a good afternoon from Lynn Simon, who is president of Simon & Associates, a firm she established in 1994. Lynn has consulted on numerous LEED certified projects, including some of the earliest projects to achieve LEED certification, and LEED is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And she's been in the movement since 1989. Prior to establishing Simon & Associates, Lynn worked with the U.S. Green Business Council and Global Green USA, a nonprofit dedicated to greening affordable housing. She's also served as the chair of the U.S. Green Business Council's Curriculum Committee, and Lynn currently serves on the U.S. GBC's Steering Committee and Management Steering Committee. She's a senior LEED faculty member, a LEED accredited professional, and a certified green building professional. Welcome, Lynn.
Well, good afternoon again. And I want to make just one correction. It's the U.S. Green Building Council versus Business Council, which sounds like a great name.
Oh, did I say Business Council?
Actually, it sounds like one of those fake green companies, but I like your name better.
And I don't even have jet lag.
So also welcome Jason. Jason McLean and I met at Bioneers. He is a nationally recognized leader in the sustainable building industry. He's an international thought leader in the green architect movement. He's lectured on sustainability across the U.S. and Canada. He's author of three books. The Philosophy of Sustainable Design is currently used as a textbook in over 40 universities and colleges and distributed widely throughout Europe and North America. He is the founder of numerous green design movements in the United States. He worked on many leading high-performance projects in the country, and he's including LEED Platinum, Gold, and Zero Energy projects. He's also, as is Jody and Lynn, a LEED certified builder. Jason is also an architect, and he was recently named one of the top 40 under 40 most influential individuals in the design and construction field by Building Design and Construction magazine. So welcome, Jason, also.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, let's just jump in there and start talking about what we mean by green building. Could you each just take a second and say what green building is to you?
Just jump in. Anyone?
Lynn, go ahead.
Okay. So, well, for me, you know, green building is looking at many environmental and healthy building issues. It's addressing issues such as indoor air quality for occupants. It is looking at energy efficiency, which we're all very familiar with here in California. We're certainly one of the leading states in that arena. It looks at materials, the types of materials we select, looking at either recycled content or low-emitting, low-toxic building materials. It's also addressing site issues, trying to get people out of their cars and get into public transit, trying to build urban infill or suburban infill so that we really aren't using green fields and using existing infrastructure. So the notion of green building is not just about a singular building. It's also, in my opinion, looking at the entire site, even looking at regional issues to address, you know, how do we make our buildings, the places we live and work, more environmental and healthy.
Great. When you talk about indoor air quality, I think that people don't really understand how much time we spend inside. There have been estimates that as high as 90% of our time we spend inside buildings. So crucial to look at what's the air like that we're breathing inside buildings, as well as what are the buildings made out of.
Go ahead.
I mean, there's many issues, you know, related to the issue. We don't even just say indoor air quality. We say indoor environmental quality, which even addresses issues like daylighting, which is one of the most important sustainability or green building strategies to incorporate into a project for many, many positive benefits.
Great. And Jason, how would you say give our audience a kind of definition from your perspective of what green building is?
Sure, and I think Lynn did a great job of
she did.
all the major areas. And so I will just leave you with kind of one sort of a single sentence definition that I like to use, which is that I think the green design or sustainable design is the philosophical approach to how you design anything, whether it's a chair, a building, a city, a neighborhood, where you're trying to maximize the quality of the design for us while minimizing or eliminating the negative environmental impact. And so it really is an approach to how you design anything.
Great.
And I would add, Michael, that it's not even just design. It's also about construction and operations.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is how do we start talking about these operational and maintenance issues on projects, which is probably operational energy use is one of the highest issues in terms of really addressing sort of sustainability and really maximizing benefits in the long term. And any way we can address those issues in the design phase, we're going to really make much better buildings.
Great. Well, before we get into the specifics of green building, and the reason I have Jody here, she's an expert in this area also, but I'm interested a little bit of the history of how we got to where we are. I just got back from Copenhagen at the conferences there, and looking at the major issues of water, air pollution, transportation, sustainable agriculture, all these different issues, but yet they all have something to do with the way we've been building homes. So, Jason, maybe you could start out. We've talked about this before, about the problems with the current way that we're building and some of the issues that come up from that.
Yeah, I think that as a society we have forgotten the whole notion of limits, and we pretty much build whatever whatever we want, wherever we want, from materials that, again, could be from wherever. And we don't pay attention to how things are made, where they're made, and how much energy, water, resources, even as Lynn was saying, the indoor environmental quality, the impacts on us. We just build whatever we want. And that has huge repercussions. And we know that the building industry, as a percentage of the overall problem, if you're talking about climate change, is staggering. And so there's an opportunity, as far as I'm concerned, to really begin to readdress, well, what is the carrying capacity of the planet? What and how should we design our communities and our buildings in order to be in line with that?
And Lynn?
So, you know, this where did we start and, you know, how did we get here? I mean, I think there's been a history, certainly in terms of energy, you know, interest in being energy efficient and conservation in many parts of the country. And I think I'm glad to hear that water was such a primary topic in Copenhagen, because it certainly was and is within the U.S. Green Building Council and at the national international conference that occurred in Phoenix last month, is the importance of many places today are in drought conditions with water. So that's become
sure.
a real high priority.
Unfortunately, it wasn't. It was a big issue trying to get it into the agenda.
Oh.
So I hate to disappoint you, but that's next week's show. I'll talk about that. But of course, many of the people there were very concerned about the issue.
Well, there's so many things we can do to address water efficiency, whether it's in buildings, our plumbing fixtures. There are many very good products out there today that have high performing and very water efficient, and there's things we can do to our irrigation systems. But I think it's something that we have not really taken, frankly, seriously enough, and the shortages that are occurring out there. And there's lots of good things we can do in projects today to even capturing rainwater and reusing it.
There are lots of good products and possibilities, but it's also a policy issue, isn't it? And I know in California, there are many places where we flush potable water all the time, at massive sums of potable water, because the city regulations or county regulations will not allow a recycling system.
Yeah, we have a very backwards view towards water in this country, and a lot of our regulations require us to do things that are inherently wasteful and energy intensive. In many parts of the country, you can't collect your rainwater, you can't use it in the building to flush toilets, or you can't use gray water, or you can't treat your waste on site. And there's a lot of technologies and systems that are available that are very proven and effective. And it is, as you outline, that there's a regulatory barrier in place. And a lot of the work that we're doing right now in our part of the country, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, Alaska, is we're busy removing or changing some of those regulations. And just this year, we were part of an effort that resulted in a change in state water law in Oregon, where just earlier in the year you couldn't collect rainwater for use in the building, and you couldn't use your gray water. Well, now you can, and so it was a huge victory for us in terms of the regulatory environment. And we're working in Washington State now to have the same results, and it's really heartwarming to see that, you know, as Lynn was saying, people are starting to pay attention to water again, and they really need to. And when, from a climate change perspective, it's interesting that saving water has huge upstream and downstream energy implications. So, and it's often cheaper in terms of reducing energy usage to make a water improvement than it is a direct energy improvement. So it's kind of interesting.
That's great to hear. I hope you're sending those precedent-setting cases down to California and Arizona.
Really?
Yeah. You know, they pay less for water in Arizona than we do in Oregon and Washington. And so the price signals are all messed.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about upstream and downstream, I'm thinking of a whole other area, the area of the materials that we use, and I'd love to talk about that. I'm thinking of cradle to cradle and biomimicry and the areas that actually look at where something comes from the point of extraction to the point of getting rid of it. And most of our buildings are quite toxic, actually. Can you talk about how they're toxic and how things are changing to look at the whole cradle to cradle kind of concept in building?
You know, there's been a huge forward sort of movement in materials in the last, I'd say, 15 years. I think product manufacturers have really, I think, stepped up in many areas to address the toxicity of their products, to address how their products are made, even the glues and adhesives and how they're installed. And so I think the good news is that today, you know, in terms of interior, certainly interior finishes, there are many more options. I kind of, when I look around a space, and, you know, wherever you're sitting, I call them the large surface areas, kind of the carpet, the paint, any, you know, ceiling tile if you're in an office building, and they're all really great alternatives today, green alternatives that are even produced by major product manufacturers. So I think the good news is we've come a long way. I think we can go a lot farther, and understanding that whole life cycle assessment of building products, which you just mentioned, Michael, is really complex. And I think we're just starting to sort of have enough a better understanding, but we frankly need more research dollars in that arena to really understand, because it's, you know, looking at extraction, harvesting, sort of the whole life cycle of that product, social outcomes as a result of where you may extract that material. So it's complex.
It is.
Yeah, I concur, and maybe if I could add a couple things that I think are interesting trends is what I'm seeing. One is that I think that there is a real push for greater transparency in the, not just the building industry, but products in general, where for a long time how things were formulated has been really like, you know, well-guarded secrets. And the consumer has a right to know whether or not something they're going to put in their house or their office is going to give them, you know, asthma or, you know, an allergy attack, or it's going to make their child sick. And, you know, we have labels, you know, in food where you can see if you're allergic to something, if there's peanuts in it, or how many calories are contained, or if you're worried about saturated fats. But when it comes to materials that we specify, we're often very much in the dark. And that's wrong, that you could be putting something next to your skin for hours a day or breathing it in, and you don't know that it's full of carcinogens. And so that as a, I think for this coming decade, I mean, it's kind of interesting that, you know, we're getting close to New Year's resolutions and things here. I think that we're going to see a real push for transparency, which on its own is going to have a huge effect in terms of making, you know, changes in how our products are made, because people are not going to buy stuff that is, that they know is really bad for them to the same degree as when they're in the dark. The other thing that I want to mention, which ties to some of the work that we're doing, and Michael, I know that you saw the presentation on the Living Building Challenge.
Yes.
When I did that at Bioneers, is we're getting an incredible amount of traction with the program, and a big part of the protocol is our materials red list, where we, through working with a bunch of different health experts, have identified the worst offenders in terms of human health from a toxicity standpoint: carcinogens, mutagens, endocrine disruptors. And we basically, our stance is there's no safe place for those in our buildings, and we have to eliminate them from the building use stream, so to speak. And so we actually require, you know, project teams to go to scrub not just a portion of their specifications, but all of their specifications, to ensure that there are none of these worst offenders. And the manufacturers are starting to take notice, even though, you know, we don't have a million projects pursuing our protocol yet. The projects that are pursuing it are so high profile that they're having an outsized positive impact in influencing manufacturers to think, maybe I don't want it to be known that my product is not going to pass the red list muster. And I think that that's a really positive thing.
That's a great point. You know, if we had as many informational labels on the products that we use every day as we do on food, as you brought up, like the calorie content that we have in a muffin versus the volatile organic chemicals that we have in our beds or our pillowcases. it might change buying habits. So the notion of healthier materials is a wonderful start, but it also kind of leads into something that's one of my pet peeves in green building, which is the affordability of healthy building. So how do we provide people with sustainable materials, things that aren't outgassing, without spending a fortune or without, you know, going to Home Depot and buying bamboo flooring from China, which has, you know, its own problems in terms of the carbon involved in transporting that?
You know, I almost think you have to make a distinction between the residential market and the commercial market, because I think in the commercial market, what the studies have found, and there are several very good studies on the cost of green building. The newest one is by Greg Katz, and that's K-A-T-S. His book is called Greening Our Built Environment, Costs, Benefits, and Strategies, and it just came out. And it, frankly, what it does is it concurs with the other studies that have been done that in the commercial side, you can build a green building and even the platinum level of the LEED rating system for, 2% or less of your construction costs. And this was done on a study done on 170 different buildings. Now, there have been some green buildings, sustainable buildings that costed upwards of 10 to 15%. But the average of this study that was done was 1.5%. So I think
1.5% more.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Exactly. So I think if you look on the commercial side, we can get achieve high levels of sustainability without a huge increase in cost. On the residential side, I think it's a little more challenging because some of the products that are out there on the residential side do cost more. And until I think there's a greater demand by the consumer for some of these products, they're going to continue to have a higher cost. Now, things like paint and some of these other, again, sort of more standard products, they don't have to cost more. But there will be some flooring and cabinets and that kind of thing that will have an increased cost. But it has come down, and I think it's a matter of maybe switching the way you look at your budgets for projects, I think is an important approach on trying to address the cost of green building.
Yeah, I if I could jump in on that, I can completely concur on the commercial side. And, I think that's a great summary. We often see no premium for project teams that have experience doing green projects, that they're able to just deliver a higher level of performance for the same cost. And, on residential projects.
Jason, excuse me just a second. You don't have your radio on or something, do you?
No, I don't.
We're getting some bad feedback.
Gone? Yeah, I was getting feedback. Is it gone now?
Yeah, it's gone now. Thanks.
Yeah, no, it was nothing on my end. And on the residential side, I think there's the discussion that needs to be had about what will we choose to value. And it's pretty interesting when I look at the stats of how the average American house size has doubled since the 1950s, and yet the average number of people within the houses has also fallen by nearly half. So we have had nearly a fourfold increase in square foot per person in terms of the way we live in this country. And I find that interesting because in the same breath people say that they can't afford green, they have just bought a house that's four times the size of what they grew up in. And so it has a lot of these discussions have a lot to do with what we decide to value. And for example, a story that I like to tell is looking at the cost of a typical two-car garage with the requisite bonus room above just happens to be the same cost of energy independence. So if you valued energy independence and climate change and never having an energy bill again, you could take your house off the grid or have a grid-tied system with 100% of your power. But if what you value is a big storage area to store stuff you don't need and you'll never use and to keep your cars from getting wet, even though they depreciate very fast, if that's what you value, then that's what you invest in. And so the whole notion of cost in this country is very interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's not a very holistic look at cost.
Yeah.
So if you want everything in your house and you want it to be huge and you want all your toys, and then you want to add on top of that, of course, there's going to be a bit extra cost. But if you re-examine what you value, it doesn't have to cost anything else.
Absolutely, the value and also the long-term costs. I think it's much easier to offset costs in commercial building than in residential. In a commercial building, you'll have the immediate return on energy savings and water savings that regular households throughout this country aren't going to see for many years.
You know, the highest cost to a building owner is in terms of sort of looking at, you know, where they spend their dollars is on the employees. It's healthcare, it's salaries. And so any way a building owner can look at green building and sustainable strategies that help support employees, good daylighting, natural ventilation, good indoor and good environmental quality, that directly will benefit that owner because you're maintaining your employees, you can recruit new employees, and you're making a better environment for them, and you're really going to invest in the long-term success of that company.
Be interesting to map against both of these things that the two of you just talked about, the happiness quotient, the larger houses and the workplace, because this obviously, I'm sure some people have done it. We had some happiness experts on here before.
Yeah, I actually looked at that, and the happiness quotient hasn't budged while we have consumed four times as much space.
Oh, I would have thought it went down.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm surprised.
No, it's been about the same from the stats that I've seen. It's sort of like, you know, all this wealth and all this stuff isn't making any difference, but it is putting us more in debt. And I think, so it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, we've been talking mostly about new construction. So, and there's a lot more areas, I think, to talk about there in terms of efficiencies and land use. But I also want to talk about the area that Jody spent a lot of time in, and that's the retrofitting of existing buildings. So, I'm thinking of the people who are listening here and probably aren't going to be buying a new house and very few building a new building, a commercial building, but a lot of people could do a lot of things to green their own homes. So could you each speak to that area and address what your thoughts are in cost-effective ways to both cut down on indoor pollution and waste and all those things and improve the quality of our lives in our homes that we have today?
You know, so there's, again, this difference between the residential and the commercial market, and I think, but the one commonality is that it is the future of sustainability. I mean, there's just, we are going to be needing to look at our existing residential and commercial projects, and that's where we can make the biggest difference in terms of addressing climate change and some of these other large water issues, our large environmental issues. We mostly concentrate on the commercial side, and we have seen a real interest in looking at sort of high-performing existing buildings and addressing operational and maintenance issues. And so we have the LEED rating system has an existing buildings rating system for commercial buildings, and we have seen a real interest and have completed almost 6 gold-certified existing buildings. Large buildings, the Wells Fargo Center in Seattle is a good example. Here in San Francisco, we have one Rincon in several others, and CalPERS in Sacramento. These are all projects that have many, many employees, but the owners, the facility engineers, and managers have all taken a real interest in looking at the operation and maintenance issues. Green housekeeping, how do you clean your building with green cleaning products? Procurement of paper or durable goods like computers, more energy-efficient computers. This is all an area that is growing, and a lot of it is about educating folks associated with existing buildings on the benefits and what they can do to make a difference.
Great. Jason?
Yeah, I guess what I would just add is that I like to tell people that regardless of your budget or the size of your project, there's always something that you can do. And sometimes people think, oh, my project is not significant enough. It doesn't matter. And I really like to encourage people to think that through. There's, you know, whether it's as simple as the paint you buy, as we talked about earlier, or putting in the right kind of toilet in your bathroom remodel can have significant, you know, downstream savings. And especially for projects that are, you know, significantly older homes and buildings, if you have a very old home with an antiquated mechanical system, heating system, people will be surprised at how quick the payback is with an upgrade of a new system. Same with lighting. And so there are things that people can do, even if they have a relatively small budget and encourage people to not be intimidated or to think they have to have a clean slate. That's often the a problem that people think, well, they have to wait till they're doing a new project for some reason. And there's a lot that you can do with an existing building to make it much much more green.
And now, Jody, this is your specialty, so any thoughts that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, I don't know if I'd say it's my specialty, but I have renovated a lot of old houses, and one of the things that I find is always a challenge is the waste. You know, sometimes I'm pulling out gorgeous old redwood and I can't wait to reuse it, or other people can't wait to take it off my hands. But there's an awful lot that is not recyclable and not reusable. Mm. And what do we do with that waste stream? I know the LEED credits, give points if you're able to recycle 75% of your waste, or a blessed occasion, 95%, which some people can do. It's very challenging when you're redoing old residential places. A lot of the wood's painted. There's just a lot of stuff that's not recyclable. What would you say about the tremendous amount of waste in the building industry?
Jason.
Well, there's a lot of waste, for sure. And I think that the percentage of waste that you see versus what can be recycled does vary depending on the market that you're in. Certain communities have infrastructure in place where a high percentage of diversion is possible. I know that in Seattle we're often seeing diversion rates that are in the 90s, and that's very encouraging. But we also do a lot of work in Alaska, and everything has to either be landfilled or shipped out. There's no infrastructure for recycling. And so it really does depend, and I would encourage people, based on wherever your listeners are, to really take a look at what's out there. There are people that will come and deconstruct things for you and salvage things. There are people that want what you have. And then making sure that when whatever is happening, the waste is being properly sorted, is a good step, so that there's a hope for things to be diverted.
And one thing I would add, again, from the design side, is architects and designers and engineers looking at how they're designing their building with that thought in mind, Jody, which is, if this building is only going to be around, or this interior space, for 50 years, and frankly, we should be building buildings that last a lot longer, and that should be one of the primary goals in terms of sort of your sustainability approach. But how do we certainly can look at those issues in design, and so that when the building is deconstructed, those things can go not to landfill, but can be recycled in some way.
What really interests me, when you're saying that, Lynn, I'm thinking of why aren't we building not only zero carbon output houses, but ones that absorb carbon? I know there are a few out there that are being built and tested and things like that, but this, really, much of this technology, there's all the leading edge new technology, but there's also the old technology that's thousands and thousands of years old that we're not following, from land use to, how we situate a building, to how we circulate air, to the thickness of the walls, all these different things. So I'm just wondering, Lynn, what are your thoughts about, are we moving to a point where we can actually build carbon-eating buildings?
Two relatively new approaches, at least in the U.S., in terms of addressing what you're talking about, Michael, or for instance, the whole notion of the vegetated roof.
Yep.
And we're even working on a school in downtown San Francisco that's going to be putting on a living wall designed by Patrick Blanc, who is a horticulturist and botanist out of France, who has designed these amazing walls of planted material with 1,500 different species of plants, because it's really about biodiversity and creating that climate and culture that can continue to thrive even if one or two species no longer can. And I think that we have some great examples today of some of these vegetated roofs on not just sort of the wonderful buildings like the California Academy of Sciences, which is an amazing vegetated roof for those of you who haven't seen it.
Yes, it is.
It's really beautiful. But even on, we're putting them on police stations. We've put it on a multifamily affordable housing project in San Jose called Casa Feliz, which is an incredible project that is, it has photovoltaics, it has vegetated roof. It's a LEED Gold project. It's multifamily affordable housing. It's for individuals with special needs. And this is a project that is not, the California Academy of Sciences. So I think it's about what Jason was mentioning is thinking differently about your project and what is important to our values. That's when we can start incorporating some of these strategies that are trying to address these larger global climate issues.
Yeah, Jason?
Yeah, I think people might find it interesting if they were to Google the International Living Building Institute, www.ilbi.org, and through that website they can connect and see what many project teams around the country are doing around this very subject. And it's quite an exciting movement that's happening to really push beyond net zero energy and net zero water. And projects, popping up everywhere. There's projects right now in 19 states and 3 provinces in Canada.
That's great. So, could you give that website one more time?
Sure. www.ilbi.org. That's the International Living Building Institute.
Great.
Gets back to what you were saying in the very beginning about our notion of limits.
Right.
And what if we had no limits? We had living walls and vegetated roofs and affordable housing for people with special needs. It was just a natural thing to imagine a living building for them, all of us.
I think that limits are actually freeing, and they produce more innovation. And I like to point out, for example, if you look at the great cuisines of the world, everyone understands food. And if you think about the wonderful, whatever your favorite food is, if you love Thai food or if you like French food or whatever it is that you like, those cuisines arose because they had to work within a limit of what grew in their area. And it created incredible innovations that created a rich diversity of food types and different things to taste and drink. And now we have this sort of bland monoculture food, right? And it's an interesting corollary to architecture and design where, the great structures of the world really arose because people had to build with what they had. And it created diversity, and it created a richness from place to place. And there was much more responsiveness to climate and to culture. And that kind of limit actually was what created the innovation. And so I think it's interesting when you think about limits as a way of not being limiting, but in fact be freeing and innovating.
Great.
Good point. I was thinking about one of the buildings I've been in England. It's an old inn that was built in 1325, and it's still operating today. So talking about the sustainable materials they had back then, still standing.
Let's talk a little bit about what people can do to both get involved and make a difference. We've got a lot of different people listening. Some of them own commercial buildings. Some of them own homes. Some of them are renters. But all of us need to be thinking right now. We have a very short window of time, which became very clear with the debating in Copenhagen the last couple of weeks. We have a very short time, and people ask, what can I do? And I know there's many ways that they can both get involved and in their own personal homes do things that are affordable and make sense, and also the way we work in our neighborhoods and our communities. Could you address some of that, Lynn?
I think there's so many ways for people to get involved sort of on a personal level. I mean, I think that Jason really said it beautifully when he said, you don't have to feel like you have to do everything. You can pick one or two things that can make a difference. So, for instance, if you live in a home and you have an opportunity to, look at your irrigation and how much water you're using, that, would be something relatively simple to do. There's also the options of putting things like photovoltaics or putting in solar hot water, which can make a difference. But, we know families that say, okay, we're not going to drive one day a week. We're going to either walk or we're going to take public transit. And, again, you can't do that in every community, but there are some communities where we can say we're going to get out of our cars. And I think that's something that we can, not feel overwhelmed and, have to spend a lot of money, but something we can take that step in trying to reduce the way we impact our environment.
Beautiful. Yeah, it's really, really interesting being in Copenhagen. I used to live in Holland and everybody bicycles. I didn't realize that almost everybody bicycles in Denmark everywhere. They don't even, you know, or they take the wonderful transit system there. Jason?
Yeah, I think that if people are looking for some actionable things, that I would encourage people to reach out to their local U.S. Green Building Council chapter as one avenue for getting involved and getting connected with others that care about, you know, green building, green design. And so, you know, there are multiple chapters in California, depending on where people live. If they just Google, you know, USGBC chapters in California, or go to the usgbc.org website and then find it through there, they can find a network of people. And really, that's the best way to get involved, is, you know, find someone like Lynn in your neighborhood. You know, find someone who is an expert and can help with, you know, your remodel project or just with interest. There's also, for people, just a great array of resources now that I wish I had when I got started in this movement. There's incredible books and videos and things, and you know, these, they're easily found on the internet, and people can do quick searches and find some amazing things to educate themselves on where to go next.
And in terms of commercial building, because while we all live in homes, we spend a lot of time in commercial buildings. Some of the projects that I know Lynn has been involved in bringing to LEED certification, the Gaia Napa Valley Hotel, the library in San Jose, City College of San Francisco Performing Arts. So it's interesting to go, and of course the Academy of the Sciences building in Golden Gate Park that we were talking about. I know Sacramento has a number of LEED certified buildings for our listeners in Sacramento. I believe one of the state buildings is a LEED Gold.
Didn't you work on that, Lynn?
Well, CalPERS has achieved a LEED Gold certification on their new building in terms of the new construction, but we also just completed LEED for existing buildings on their existing building, and they have made a real commitment to achieve high levels of sustainability. And there are other projects and state buildings in and around Sacramento, and you can Google, you know, green buildings in California, and I think people will be amazed. And this is the beauty of green building. They don't necessarily look quote-unquote green. They're just good, beautifully designed buildings that are high-performing, that are doing all the things we've been talking about, but there's nothing unusual about them. It's sort of my whole interest, and I think the U.S. Green Building Council's, is how do we mainstream green? And that's what we're trying to do on all these projects, because that's, I think, where we're really going to make a significant difference.
And yet it's interesting, even though they don't look any different, to look around them and see what these green features are. I know right here in Grass Valley, the food co-op is a LEED certified building, and they have little notes about certain things so that you can see, oh, you know, the floor is made out of this and the paint is low VOC, et cetera. So it is interesting to just note what these green features are and how seamlessly they blend in.
We've got just a few minutes left, but I'd like to talk about some of the weird things, actually. some of the, because there's some amazing new trends and inventions and things coming down the pike, which I'm sure both of you are up to speed on, incorporating many of the new concepts, which are very old concepts, of things like biomimicry, you know, using nature's design and ways to use air currents and the heat of the land. And there's so many different things that are being innovated, and are many of them are actually already available. Can you start that out, Jason? Just talk about a few of the ones that just dazzle you.
Sure, and this is a subject that I get quite excited about. We do a lot of
me
work.
Me too.
Yeah, we do a lot of work with Janine Benyus and the Biomimicry Institute, and it is amazing what in fact nature has already come up with. And I think that there's this incredible, sometimes arrogance that we think that it's humanity that's the real innovators, and certainly we're an innovative species, but nature has already figured out how to solve just about every design challenge that we're still working on, and to do it without a toxic legacy and a ton of energy use. And so it's really inspiring when we are humble enough to stop, turn around, and say, well, how would nature solve this? how would we do it so that it's truly sustainable? And I would point your listeners to a great website that they run called AskNature.org. And it's just a lot of fun to go there and take a look at how different solutions in terms of capturing energy or gathering water or colors or, you know, it's amazing what is out there. Now, a lot of these things are in terms of, like, being ready for commercialization. Some of them are still a few years off, but very promising. And other things are already finding their way into the mainstream world. There's some new wind turbine designs that were patterned after different species and how they operate. There's one in Canada that was patterned after the tubercles on a whale's fin. And for a long time, people thought that the whale's fin, you know, wasn't very efficient in water because it had all these weird bumps and things. And we always thought that aerodynamic shapes had to be smooth. And what we're learning from this whale is that, in fact, there is method to the apparent madness, and that these actual shapes actually help reduce vortices that go off of the fin in such a way that there is more efficiency as they cut through the water. And air is just like water in terms of being a fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're learning some surprising things where we had been blinded by our own perceptions of how the world worked, when nature isn't really blinded by those. It just does what works.
Good example. That website was AskNature.org?
AskNature.org. And
great.
You know, you can spend quite a bit of time poking around in there. That's where I'd send people.
Okay. Jody?
Well, actually, I have a slightly unrelated question, and this is for Lynn. Lynn, you have been involved in green buildings since 1989, and my question to you just simply is, what was it like for a woman in the field, an architect, to start out and have these ideas, and how were you received?
You know, I feel like I've been really fortunate, Jody. I mean, I have, you know, the building industry is still, you know, heavily male-dominated in terms of, you know, construction, obviously, and even in architecture. But I feel very much, I have not, you know, seldom, you know, have I been discriminated against. I mean, every now and then I may have an older gentleman, you know, call me honey. But, you know, in general, I think it's about how, you know, if you treat people with respect, they'll treat you with respect. If you can demonstrate your knowledge and understanding and expertise, they'll respect that. So I think for me, even though I feel very fortunate, I still, it's very important to me to be a role model for young women. And often I think, for me, when I talk to young women and that are entering the profession, I talk about the importance of understanding their own value and what they're offering to you know, the profession or to a client, and that they should, you know, equal pay as men, really. But we have to give these young women confidence that they're contributing and really value, can provide incredible value to the process.
That's great. Good question, too. I don't want to leave you out, Lynn, of the groovy things, though, too, if you had a couple.
Well, you know, I have to say,
is that just a guy thing?
No, I have to say, so this is a little, it's strange to talk about this. So City Center is the largest development in the United States. It's 18 million square feet. It's in Las Vegas. It just got six of the buildings just achieved LEED Gold. Now, we can have a lot of, we don't have time to have the discussion about the project being built and the fact that there's a casino, which is the one piece that did not get certified. But even though the casino, they still allow smoking, and maybe someday they won't, what they have done, which was really amazing to me, is on the gaming tables surrounding the dealer, they have air vents coming out so that when the person is smoking, that dealer will not be subjected to those harmful carcinogens from the smoke. And so even, you know, underneath the gaming tables, they have airflow coming out. So, you know, it's not perfect. Yes, I would prefer that they didn't allow smoking, but there are some of these newer technologies and strategies that are helping address some of these issues.
That's great. Well, we're getting towards the end of the time here. I'd actually like to ask all three of you to perhaps make a closing statement about where you think the field is going. Oh, Jody, you have a question you want to ask? Yes. Oh, she doesn't want me to ask her, but I'm going to anyway. I'm all three of you are all LEED certified. You certainly all have opinions about it. So, you know, where is the field going? What do you see? What gives you hope about, you know, this? Because, you know, buildings take up an enormous amount of something like 30% of all of our energy is used in heating, cooling, and dealing with buildings. So, what do you see in the future? What gives you hope is a way of just closing out the show today. And Lynn, why don't you start?
You know, I'm completely encouraged and inspired by so many areas in sustainability. I mean, I think that there are so many different types of people in terms of, you know, whether it's contractors or engineers or architects that are embracing this. And I am always heartened when I go into a meeting and at first maybe the people are a little gun-shy about sustainability, but then they realize how important it is and what a difference they can make and how they really do embrace it. So I'm really encouraged by the future, and we have a lot of work to do, and I think that, but we have some amazing individuals and leaders out there that are helping us move in that direction.
Great. Jason?
Yeah, I'm encouraged by the rate of adoption. I do think that when it comes to climate change, that all of us are way behind in the kind of scale improvements that we need to make. But I actually think that, to answer your question, that's what's coming, is I think that we're going to see not minor shifts forward, but giant leaps forward in terms of how our buildings perform over this decade. And I think we're going to really be, you know, forced with addressing the issues of resource consumption and water consumption and energy consumption in this next decade, and definitely in the next two decades. And so innovation is either going to come from us or it's going to be thrust upon us. So I would say, if crystal ball, the world is going to be a very different place by 2030, and green building is going to be at the heart of that change. And I take great heart in seeing how many people are adopting the Living Building Challenge, which is an incredibly stringent, hard standard to reach, and the fact that we're going to have the world's first living building certified this year in 2010, potentially up to four of them, is huge in terms of models of the future.
Very exciting. And Jody, last words.
Well, I agree with everything that Lynn and Jason have said. I'm just I'm thrilled by the growth of the green building movement, and thank you very much for being with us today in these conversations.
Yeah, I want to thank all three of you for the work you're doing and pioneering work in really different areas, but the same issue. And it's just something that we really need and really need to get out there. So I know for all our listeners on Conversations, I want to thank you for taking the time for being here with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Happy holidays.
Oh, to you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, green building. Well, next week we're going to be talking about Copenhagen. I didn't think I could pull it together for today, and I'm just so grateful for Jody Saleen coming up from the Bay Area to join us today and be part of the show.
Always a pleasure and privilege to be at KVMR.
Yeah, and with you. And thanks also to Sierra Solar Systems, serving the foothill and the environment for 29 years, offering PG&E and remote system design. Whoa! Somebody switched music on me here. I didn't realize that. Okay, Sierra Solar Systems, serving the foothills and the environment for 29 years, offering PG&E and remote system design and installation. Their solar-powered showroom and warehouse is at the Alternative Building Center, 563 Idaho Maryland Road. That's in Grass Valley. And 530-273-6754, sierrasolar.com. Next week, I will be having interviews with that I've done with Vandana Shiva, Indian's physicist turned agriculture reform, with Bill McKibben, the founder of 350.org, and with who else? Oh, George Monbiot. You'll love George Monbiot. He's amazing, and he will dazzle you. So I look forward to being with you next week and talking about Copenhagen. You can still catch the newscasts for the last 2 weeks. Just go to the homepage, kvmr.org. And you can listen to some of the news if you missed any of that. Thanks so much for listening, and I will talk to you next week.